This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the completely redesigned 300-horsepower MDX. More information is available at acura.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? And you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week, America's 40 million Latinos are avid moviegoers, DVD buyers, and TV watchers. So why doesn't Hollywood seem to care? Then, the Dixie Chicks get, well, Dixie Chicked. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. It's the Hollywood News Caravan special You Screwed Me edition. A federal judge in New York ordered a plagiarism case against DreamWorks and Warner Brothers to trial. It centers on who's the originator of Michael Bay's Humans as Spare Parts movie, The Island. Normally, we don't weigh in on such disputes, but then we read the studio's counterargument, which seems so utterly slimy, so morally bereft, we felt a special moral obligation to get involved. As Variety reported, quote, "When the lawsuit was filed, DreamWorks issued a statement saying that The Island was independently created and did not infringe on anyone's copyrights. Those issues aside, DreamWorks has also argued plaintiffs were not entitled to any damages because The Island wasn't profitable." End quote. This is tantamount to DreamWorks arguing, even if we did shoplift that rump roast, we shouldn't have to pay for it because we wound up burning dinner anyway. And you wonder why people make jokes about lawyers. From rump roasts to actual roasts, media moguls lined up last week to toast Tom Freston, the recently fired CEO of Sumner Redstone's Viacom. At one point in the lunch, News Corporation President Peter Chernin wondered aloud how it would feel, as he put it, to, quote, "be screwed by a guy so old that he had to take a little blue pill to do it," end quote. Elsewhere, in the Magic Kingdom, the triumphant return of ABC's reality show Extreme Makeover was as short-lived as one of Cher's facelifts. ABC yanked the plastic surgery extravaganza after a single dismally rated appearance in the 8 o'clock Friday time slot. Beginning November 3rd, ABC will resume airing a repeat of Grey's Anatomy in the first hour of primetime. Apparently, given a choice between watching real people have surgery so they can look fake and fake people pretending to do surgery that's real, the choice was clear. Finally, it's been a month of musical mayhem, and all of it generated by the much-detested former wives of deceased or aged rock stars. 2 weeks ago, Yoko Ono sued music company EMI for $10 million, claiming she was cheated out of royalties from the sale of recordings by her late husband John Lennon. Last week, Heather Mills McCartney sued British newspapers over coverage of her acrimonious split from Sir Paul McCartney. And now, the clincher. Forbes reported last week that Courtney Love, wife of the now-defunct godfather of grunge, Kurt Cobain, has sold some of her stake in his catalog of songs to be used as fodder for commercial jingles. Love discovered she was down to her last $4,000, and as such, she sold a quarter of her stake in the back catalog of Nirvana's songs to Larry Mestel, the ex-general manager of Virgin Records. Her take? 50 million big ones. The creative pilfering will begin when a handful of Nirvana songs are inserted into episodes of CSI Miami during the November Nielsen ratings. That's when advertisers gauge audience sizes to set their rates for the coming 6 months. Kurt would be so proud.
The face, the face of the man who sold the world.
And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later on the show, shut up and sing. But next, should 20th Century Fox become 20th Vicente Fox? Horror freaks, Christians, urbanites, it seems there isn't a demographic that hasn't gotten its own movie division in Hollywood. Except, of course, Latinos. In June, Universal announced they'd try to penetrate the market, hiring director and producer John Singleton to create a slate of low-budget features specifically for Latino audiences. And, well, they should. The 2004 census reported that 14% of all Americans are of Hispanic or Latino origin. But get this. A study by the University of Georgia found that they account for 30% of all moviegoers. And Latinos spent some $5 billion on DVD purchases in 2005, 1.5 times more than the average gringo. But America's 40 million Hispanics haven't been so easy to romance. In 2001, Universal partnered with the Hispanic entertainment marketing firm The Uranus Group to make and distribute films for America's Latinos. The result was, unfortunately, just one movie, the gangster film Empire, starring John Leguizamo. But the financing for the joint venture fizzled, and aside from the new Singleton initiative, the town's been largely flummoxed when it comes to turning the rising brown tide into box office green. Santiago Pozo is the CEO of Arenas, the company that made the deal with Universal a few years ago. He's still very much in the business of marketing film and TV to Hispanics. Santiago, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Is there such a thing as a Latino? And if so, what is a Latino?
Well, let's start with what is not a Latino. Latino is not a race, because we come in all shapes and colors, from black Dominicans to very white, blonde hair, Cubans or Spaniards. Why? Because the genetic pool that creates the Hispanic or the Latino person is Jewish, Arab, Phoenician, Roman, Greek, Aztec, Mayan, Native American, so you name it. So we are not a race. We are a culture, though. And that is, for this particular business, that's key, because this is a cultural business. And we share a language, we share sensibilities and points of view on big issues in life, family, God, religion, etc.
Given that, can you market to Latinos, or by definition, do you have to have 47 different campaigns going at once?
Well, that you can market to Latinos, I'm a living proof, because I started my business in 88 out of my living room in my house in Studio City. And today here we are in Beverly Hills with 30-plus employees. Yes, you can market to Latinos.
So then the question...
As a matter of fact, in today America, not to market to Latinos is bad business.
When the studios talk about black audience, what they're really talking about is urban audiences. Do the studios think of the Latino audience in the same way? Have the studios and networks in America, for the most part, ghettoized the Latin audience?
When you talk about the Latino market and the black market, the African-American market, there is an area of intersection that is precisely the urban market, or what we, marketeers call the urban market. That means that the Latino market and the African-American market is the same? No, it's not. There is a part of the urban market that is shared by both. But assuming that that is the same market, that the African-American market and the Latino market is the same, is not true. Because then there is other markets, other parts of the Latino market, and other parts of the African-American market that has nothing to do with the urban market. The middle class, the rural, etc.
Is the issue one of product or one of marketing or both?
I think the issue is both. And both issues are cultural. And this is very important to understand, particularly in this industry, in either film or television. If we were in the energy industry, it doesn't matter where the oil comes from. But when you are trying to market something, you have to push emotional buttons in the audience in order to create a customer. Those buttons in this particular industry in entertainment are cultural. So there is a problem with shortage of product that is culturally relevant to the market. It's a problem with the studios perceiving what the Latino market is and putting the dollars in marketing and distribution or even in production behind a product that maybe they don't have the sensibility, or the gatekeepers of the studio don't have the sensibility to understand fully. And then third is a problem in marketing. So it's a problem in both.
Why haven't the studios come to understand what the equation for success is? Is there an equation? And why are they ignoring it if there is one?
Well, first of all, people running the studios are, in general, capable and intelligent professionals. So I have respect for what the studios are doing. Now, could they do more? Yes. I think that the first thing that is important is to create Latino professionals and to open opportunities for Latino professionals, precisely because I was telling you before that it's a cultural industry, and culture then can be a determining factor in success or failure. But that is not only the responsibility of the studios. That is the responsibility of the Hispanic community as a whole. We are moving fast in the American dream. Actually, I think we are the ones carrying the American dream flag right now, because I think the rest of America has got a little comfortable and a little lazy.
What do you think the fundamental misunderstanding is in Anglo media about marketing to Latinos, about the whole Latino audience?
That you are reaching them through English media already, that Latinos are like anybody else in the country, that you don't need to have anything special going through. They are acculturated already. That is not such an important market that can make a product succeed or fail. That is so fragmented that it's impossible to reach, that a Cuban has nothing to do with a Mexican nothing with a Spaniard nothing with a Puerto Rican.
You're listening to The Business. I'm talking with Santiago Pozo, CEO of the Orenas Group, which has a long history of marketing TV and movies to American Latinos. Recently, Orenas was given a sizable budget to create campaigns for two ABC shows, Desperate Housewives and Ugly Betty. The reasons they chose these shows was simple. Housewives is so over the top, it might as well be a Latin American telenovela. And Ugly Betty is an expensive American version of Betty La Fea, the world's most popular Spanish language program. The story of an ugly girl, ugly's in quotes because it's always a beautiful girl made to look less beautiful, but an ugly girl who gets a job in high fashion. For Santiago Pozo and the Arenas Group, Ugly Betty presented some interesting challenges. Here's one of the TV ads they created for the launch of the show last month.
Listen to the ballad of Ugly Betty. In New York, she works in fashion with sophisticated people and incredible women. Armed with her self-confidence and her poncho from Guadalajara,
oh my God.
The new comedy Ugly Betty. So ugly, we made it in English.
The ad tells Latin audiences, one, that this is the Betty La Fea they know and love, but two, it's in New York, and it's a comedy. The phrase, so ugly we made it in English, not only reminds people the show's in English, but that Spanish speakers should take special pride in the fact that a Latin show was so good it made it to the U.S. I asked Santiago Pozo of the Arenas Group about the Mexican ballad they used in the spot, and he said that the corrido, as it's known, has been accepted as a kind of pan-Latino music. But they also produced a version of the ad with reggaeton, a popular Latin hip-hop style. How many different versions did you have to really create in order to reach, quote-unquote, Latino America?
Depends on the budget and depends on the goals that you set.
In the case of ABC.
Well, no, but let me answer this in a more general question first, and then we go to the ABC case. The Latino market is fragmented, yes. So is the general market. A Cuban and a Mexican are different, yes. So is a guy from New York and a guy from the Deep South. Now, in the ideal world, you will create a campaign for the general market that is target custom made for the New Yorker and custom made from the guy in Alabama or in Texas. The truth is, for budget considerations, what you try to do is to create a campaign that will reach the New Yorker, and will reach the guy in Alabama if possible. When we go after the Latino market, we try to do the same. And through the years, this company, I think, has learned certain principles that you need to apply. Many, many years ago, we marketed a picture called My Family, Mi Familia. That was about a Chicano family in East Los Angeles. We did tremendous business all through the Southwest. We die in New York and Miami. 15 years later, we have done Empire, about Latino, Puerto Rican in the Bronx.
You're talking about the movie Empire that starred John Leguizamo.
Correct. The per screen average in the Southwest, in Houston, in Dallas, in Los Angeles, were the same than in New York or in Miami. Why? Because we have learned how to talk to all Latinos with a voice that communicates essential things that will touch that mysterious button in the audience that will make them become customers.
Is the mistake that studios make in trying to reach this audience is that they wind up being too politically correct? That is, they say, we got to make a campaign that recognizes the fundamental dignity and worth of Cuban Americans, and then of the Salvadorans, and of the Argentinians and the Mexicans, and they get too diffuse, when in fact there are certain quote-unquote stereotypes about Latins that are true and that resonate and that Latinos find amusing as hell and that Whitey is just too terrified to say.
No, under my watch. You know, because I think when clients hire Arenas, when studios hire Arenas, or when networks hire Arenas, I think what they find here is a company that for 19 years have marketed over 300 feature films. We have seen it almost all. And we are free to joke about ourselves. And I think both campaigns, Ugly Betty and Desperate Housewife, show that we are Latinos creating jokes inside our community that our community appreciate, actually. Are other companies trying to be politically correct when address the Latino market? I think you're right. And I think that, you know, is not serving the purpose, because what's happening is your advertisement expression, it doesn't reach the audience with the vigor and the force that you can have.
Santiago Pozo, thank you.
No, thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and I wish we could have much more time to talk about all this fascinating market.
Come back anytime.
Anytime you want.
In 2003, the country trio The Dixie Chicks were the number one selling female group in the country. But on the eve of the second Gulf War, lead singer Natalie Maines made an impromptu remark while playing at a club in London.
We're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas.
Those 12 words, "and we're ashamed that the President of the United States is from Texas," resulted in a fury from Bush supporters and a near boycott of the Chicks' music on country radio stations throughout the U.S.
They should send her to Iraq, strap her to a bomb, and just drop her over Baghdad.
Last Friday, a film called Shut Up and Sing was released, documenting the comment and its effect on the band.
The Red Cross wouldn't take $1 million from us.
Well, you do know that George W. Bush is the honorary chairman.
Directed by Oscar-winning filmmaker Barbara Kopple and her co-director Cecilia Peck, Shut Up and Sing follows the ordeal of the Chicks and captures the spirit and the talent that made them so popular in the first place. The documentary is also a testament to how radio was morphed by the Telecommunications Act of 1996. After a short break, we'll have more about that with Simon Renshaw, the manager of the Dixie Chicks. You're listening to The Business from National Public Radio. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. On the eve of the Second Gulf War, the lead singer of the popular country act, the Dixie Chicks, made an impromptu comment critical of the president.
We're ashamed the president of the United States is from Texas.
Those 12 words uttered in a small club in London caused an uproar across the pond in the U.S. The result was that many, many country stations stopped playing the Chicks' music. But this cautionary tale is more about the effects of deregulation than politics. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 eliminated the restrictions on the number of radio stations any one company could own. Where at one time each station would have had to decide what to do about the Dixie Chicks on its own, after the act, the thumbs down by right-wing pressure groups on a few corporate honchos was able to seal their fate. Simon Renshaw is the manager of the Dixie Chicks. Simon Renshaw, welcome to the business.
Hi, good evening.
Before all of this went down, had you even heard of the Telecommunications Act of 1996?
Oh, yes. I was very familiar with the act and more particularly with the results of what the act allowed to occur.
Had you benefited at all from this sort of corporate multi-station ownership?
No, I think you
were hurt by it?
No, I think there was certainly amongst my colleagues and peers on the artist management side, we always felt that it had been a very, very damaging blow to the music business. It's definitely something where we have seen sort of more national playlists, less autonomy and less programming being done at a local level.
Of course, if you're sort of on those corporate playlists, that's a good thing, though, right? I mean, if you're sort of endlessly in the rotation.
Oh, absolutely. Of course. It's great for the artists that are on them, and it's very, very tough for the artists that aren't on them to get on them.
There's this very poignant scene in the film right at the beginning where you sort of jokingly say, this is going to be great publicity. Wouldn't it be great if we could get some bands and some CD burnings? And you have that, you know, as an audience, you kind of cringe and go, oh, Simon,
yes,
you have no idea that the gods are listening.
But, you know, we had no idea at that time, just, you know, the nature of the beast that we had encountered. I mean, you know, there was a very, very organized attempt to very publicly punish the Dixie Chicks. And it was, I believe, intended to send a very clear message to anyone else who would dare to dissent or to question. And I think in that respect, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the girls talk about in the movie, there's a part, I think, where Marcy says something about, well, you know, now there's even a verb, you know, and people refer to it being Dixie Chicked. And, you know, back in 2003, in the spring, people were referring to people being Dixie Chicked. Oh, don't say that. Don't go there. You don't want to get Dixie Chicked.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible for the damage that was done to your band to have been done were it not for the consolidation of the radio business?
I think it would have been a lot harder in 1995 than it was in 2003. The fact that, you know, you had radio networks like Cumulus and like Cox, you know, where, you know, corporate edicts from the boardroom were issued, right? That the music there was to, you know, they were to stop playing the Dixie Chicks music.
You sort of went on to testify before Congress,
yeah,
about all of this.
The wild thing about it was that there, giving testimony on behalf of the radio station groups, was John Dickey, who was the head of Cumulus, who was the guy who'd ordered the ban on the Dixie Chicks. Which led to sort of quite a spirited exchange between sort of some of the members of the FTC and Mr. Dickey.
It was actually John McCain who was, and continues to be, a real opponent of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, who really socked it to the head of Cumulus.
We are a confederation of 270 individual stations.
You made a decision from corporate headquarters that was binding on your DJ.
Mr. Chairman.
And just prior to that, you say that you're an independent radio station. That's a total contradiction.
What has been the sort of bottom line effect financially and creatively for the Chicks? I asked that hoping you'll answer it in specific address, you know, what it might have cost to, say, let someone off the hook for a tour like Lipton.
Lipton weren't let off the hook. Lipton actually honored all of the commitments they've made to us.
Well, let me ask you about that specifically. At mm-hmm. one point, there's a meeting with a Lipton consultant, and Natalie mm-hmm. Maines offers yeah. to, as she put it, let them off the hook. How much would letting them off the hook have cost the Dixie Chicks?
Well, I can't really go into those kind of specific numbers because obviously sort of agreements...
Well, I guess...
Those agreements, I mean...
Without disclosing your tax returns or anything like that.
They are multi-million dollar deals.
They are. And yeah. And in terms of a percentage cost of the tour, do they pay for half the tour or
most
of the tour?
No.
A big chunk of it. They're
a very small... That, I mean, to be honest with you, sort of the sponsorship and endorsement revenue stream is on that tour was certainly a minor piece of the equation. So that was certainly nothing that was really concerning. And again, you know, on that tour, you know, that tour had sold out.
Right. Yeah. So
way before this had all, or weeks before this had gone down.
So letting a spider. Hang
on a second.
Sure. Is that your?
That's my ringtone.
Is that your? It's very politically correct.
Yeah, and it's very annoying. I'm going to have to change that.
I won't tell Natalie you said so.
She doesn't have it on her phone.
Well, so. That would be a little megalomaniacal.
Exactly.
Maniacal.
But if you look at it, there's another way you could look at it in terms of what does it cost. You know, I think that on the last record release, we ended up selling, I think, about 6 million records. I think the current projection, that's 6 million records in North America. There was more outside.
Right. Sure.
So I think that, you know, if you look at it in terms of record sales, if you know, the last record in North America, the Home album, did about 6 million records in North America. The current projections from the record company for this record are for this record to do about 3 million units.
Mm-hmm.
You know, touring-wise, on the last tour of North America in 2003, I think the average number of paid tickets per night was around 15,000 tickets. I think on the current North American tour, the average number of paid tickets is around 9,000 and a couple of hundred a night. So, I mean, obviously it's obviously had a serious effect in terms of the gross revenues on the business. But I think that on the other hand, and I think it's one of the things that you see in the film, is I think that you see that this was also sort of artistically liberating for the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And it really removed some of the constraints that they felt they were under in terms of, you know, well, we have to make a record that's going to appeal to country radio, or we have to make a record that's going to appeal to this type of fan base.
Right, so songs about pickup trucks or dogs no longer are de rigueur. You can sort of say, screw
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
We don't have to appeal to a base that doesn't want us.
Exactly. And it was, you know, and I think the other thing that was so shocking to them was, well, to all of us, was just how quickly people turned on them and just how vilified they were. And at the same time, it was, you know, there was some very scary, you know, I mean, when the vilification ends up with people actually making death threats, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, you have to think that it really, you know, it's really gone beyond any sort of realms of sort of political correctness, if you will. I mean, this is just, you know, this is monstrous behavior.
Yeah. Simon Renshaw is manager of the Dixie Chicks and lots of other bands. Simon, thanks for being on The Business.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Burdesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.